Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and on today I'll be talking to the author of Polarization, What Everyone Needs to Know. The book is published by Oxford University Press, and the author is Nolan McCarty. Nolan, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great.
We're in the middle of summer. It's hot. You have written this really interesting book that covers a lot of the things that people are talking about. And often talking about in not quite the right way. If they read your book, they would talk about it in a much more precise way. Before we talk about this work on polarization, maybe you can just share a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, I'm a professor of politics and public affairs at Princeton University. And I've been working on the topic of polarization for about 25 years now. So it's been quite a growth industry. I used to have to convince people that it was actually happening. Now I have to convince people maybe it's not as bad as they think it is. So it's come full circle. So it's a delight to have written the book and to be able to talk about it with your listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. It does feel like one of the benefits of sticking around is you get to take those things that seem so novel and then they become commonplace. I guess that means, you know, you're right at some point. So let's start with the book. And what I thought was a really useful explanation at the beginning of the book of three of the common versions of polarization. There's probably dozens more that people use in kind of common parlance, but there's sort of three core ones. And you distinguish them in conceptual terms at the beginning of the book: policy, ideological, and partisan polarization. I thought maybe we can start there just with maybe you could sort of briefly walk us through what those three ways of talking about polarization mean, and then we'll get to the other parts of the book later.
Sure. So as I note in the book, polarization is a term that's often used to describe almost everything that's bad about American politics and increasingly bad about the politics of other countries. But I think it's very important to understand what's going on to make some important distinctions. So typically by polarization, we mean some process by which extreme viewpoints or extreme behaviors become more common relative to more moderate or centrist or conventional behaviors. So in the context of American politics, there are very distinct ways in which we can think about that process of increasing extremes. We can think of it in terms of policy positions in the extent to which take a particular policy area like abortion or gay rights. The extreme viewpoints on that issue become more common. There are many more pro-choice voters, many more pro-life voters, and the number of people who take a centrist position declines. So we could call that policy polarization. It's really specific to the policy preferences on a particular issue. But more broadly than that, we can think in terms of ideological polarization. Political science and social science and others have recognized that policy positions across issues tend to go together, cluster together in ways that are kind of, you know, at least semi-consistent. So people can be kind of consistently liberal or consistently conservative. So we can think of ideological polarization as a process in which the extent to which people are consistently liberal or consistently conservative have grown relative to people whose positions tend to cluster on the moderate end of the scale. And so we can call that ideological polarization. But increasingly, there's been a third use of polarization, which I understand why people use it, but it's become a little, I argue in the book, a little confusing. And that's to think purely in terms of partisan polarization, the extent to which Democrats differ from Republicans. And it's often used in kind of a less policy-oriented way, more of an effective way, meaning basically Democrats dislike Republicans increasingly, Republicans dislike Democrats increasingly. So that's a sort of a valid use of polarization, but it bleeds into a separate concept of just simple partisanship. So one of the things I try to do in the book is where it's really important for understanding the resurgence implications, to draw out those distinctions, try to say what is policy polarization, what is based on more broad ideological terms, and how much can be just thought of as just pure partisanship, tribalism, or as it's been called in the literature, affective polarization.
Right. Now, however one refers to it, polarization is especially meaningful if it varies dramatically. And I think there's a lot of ways that we feel like the world is growing more polarized, whether it's ideologically speaking or policy. But what do the data actually show us? And in chapter three, you do this survey of these various sources of data. What do the different measures tell us about this trend in, you focus on elite polarization over the last 100 or so years?
That's right. So one of the things, when I talk about the trends and changes, I should really stress that distinction between elite polarization, the type of polarization that occurs among party activists, elected officials, government officials, and that occurs at lower levels than the mass public, voters, regular citizens. At the elite level, we're able to use a variety of data sources to kind of assess long-term trajectories in polarization. So the most common used data is the congressional roll call voting record, where we can, which exists for the entirety of U.S. history, and we can use either some conventional measures of the extent to which there's partisanship in voting, or some more sophisticated measures that attempt to estimate the liberalism or conservatism of members of Congress. And we can use those to track the extent to which different groups of legislators, in particular different partisan groups, have diverged from one another, the extent to which they've stopped cooperating with each other. And so we get some pretty striking patterns out of those data, in that it shows both that polarization in contemporary United States is at a very high level relative to its history, but also that it's varied a lot over time. So the most commonly used measures show that U.S. politics was very polarized from the end of Reconstruction through the 1920s, began to fall and stabilize at a low level throughout World War II, the Great Depression, much of the 1950s and 60s. And then our current trajectory of polarization really began in the late 1970s, 76 or 77, and has grown to levels that rival those that we saw coming out of Reconstruction. So it's both true that polarization is quite high. It's also true that there have been times in U.S. history when it's been relatively low, that bipartisanship was the norm. Increasingly, we've been able to supplement those data on congressional voting with a wide variety of other measures based on surveys of candidates for office, data that looks at campaign contribution patterns, even data that looks at social media usage by members of Congress and by politically sophisticated people. And they all showed the same thing, that American politics is very polarized now, and then it's been growing over the past several decades.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Now, to say that elites are polarized is one thing. To say the public is polarized is a very different thing. And this is an area that's generated so much debate in the field. What are the rough sides of this debate, and where do you come down on one of the major questions, dividing points in the field of the last, say, couple decades?
Yes, it may surprise many of your listeners and perhaps the readers of the book that there actually is a debate as to whether or not the American public is polarized at all. So there's kind of an influential argument by Morris Fiorina at Stanford, which says most of what we've seen in American politics is not polarization in a policy or ideological sense. He argues that the number of centrists, either ideological or on a variety of policy issues, has not gone down, that much of the distribution of political preferences is very kind of bell-shaped or normal, and that what we've seen instead is a pattern of partisan sorting where conservative voters have increasingly identified with the Republican Party and liberal voters have increasingly aligned with the Democratic Party. So, in his terminology, we don't see polarization. We merely see this process of partisan sorting. I'll come back in a second about the question about whether we should just treat sorting as a mere phenomenon instead of as an important one. Other scholars, notably Alan Abramowitz, have sort of questioned that interpretation of the data and has really stressed the extent to which the policy and ideological differences across partisans, especially the more sophisticated and active partisans, have in fact grown over time in ways that he suggests are not just simply merely sorting, but a broader process of polarization. So there's a debate about the extent of voter polarization, in large part because it's hard to disentangle the sorting, conservatives becoming Republicans and liberals becoming Democrats, from the process of conservatives becoming more conservative and liberals becoming more liberal. The other aspect of this, though, is the timing. I don't think either set of scholars, there are a few exceptions of kind of newer work, but I don't think either of the people who have spent the most time working on this have found evidence to suggest that the process of sorting among the public or polarization among the public preceded the polarization of the elites. So I think the most consistent interpretation of the data is that the elites, high-level partisan actors, partisans, activists, party officials, they polarize first, leading to a process both of sorting. So as the Republican Party becomes more conservative and the Democratic Party becomes more liberal, it makes sense for conservatives to increasingly join the Republican Party and for liberal voters to increasingly join the Democratic Party, but also a process of polarization as voters, especially committed partisan voters, tend to adopt the policy preferences of their party. So I guess I come somewhere in the middle. I believe that there's, important processes both of sorting and polarization. But the thing I would stress is that on some level, it doesn't matter very much. The fact that The Republican Party base is almost uniformly conservative, and the Democratic Party base is almost as uniformly liberal or progressive, has profound implications for how American politics works, independently of whether it's polarization or sorting.
About a year ago, we had Sam Rosenfeld on the podcast talking about not the phenomenon of polarization, but the reaction of scholars and others to a period of low-level polarization. At the beginning of our conversation, you talked about this sort of almost universally being viewed as a bad thing. Is this a bad thing? Is it a okay thing? What are the harms that might be felt from a period of historical polarization? Where do you come down on what this what the impact of this is on other dimensions of our politics?
Sure, that's a great question. So, in principle, polarization may not be a bad thing, and Sam had written a really good book explaining all the reasons why activists and scholars were upset about the lack of partisan differentiation. Because absent that partisan differentiation, it's very hard to hold parties accountable if parties don't have a clear set of principles or brands. And so some level of polarization, I think, is extremely necessary for the functioning, of a democratic system. We don't want all politicians to be in the middle when voters don't always share those middling preferences. But I think that our political institutions in the United States are not well suited for high levels or extreme levels of polarization. We have a system with lots of checks and balances, separation of powers, differences at the federal and the state levels. They require, some level of cooperation that usually can only be met if there's some sorts of bipartisan compromises. So polarization might, and I argue that it has, reached a point in which if we can no longer make those bipartisan agreements or reach broad consensuses, that our system is just not going to function very efficiently. If Congress can't pass laws, then power will flow away from Congress and we'll see the aggrandizement of executives and judges. Then we observe extreme politicization of the executive branch and the courts as a response to that. It creates its own set of problems. And so the commonly recognized dilemma of polarization is it creates legislative, at least in Congress, it creates legislative gridlock, has lots of downstream effects that I think have been very bad for our politics. And then there are the downstream effects into the public and the public's willingness to accept legitimate disagreements about political views. And that in turn creates a set of problems, for American democracy. So a little polarization is a good thing. A lot of polarization, I think, creates a fair amount of collateral damage.
How does Donald Trump fit into this story you tell? Is he more of the same, sort of fits on this trajectory that you've described, or something dramatically different, either as a cause of more polarization or maybe simply a powerful force to lock current levels of polarization in for decades to come? So what about the president?
Yeah, so that's the concluding chapter of my book, and obviously you don't always write the last chapter last, but in this case, I insisted upon writing the last chapter last. In fact, the book even went out to reviewers without the last chapter because I didn't want to write that chapter, 1 second too soon. So I tackle exactly that question. How much of Donald Trump is a continuation of patterns that we've seen, how much of it's new, how much of his presidency is likely to affect the extent of partisan polarization. And there are lots of countervailing effects here. I mean, the first and most obvious is that Donald Trump is not a conventional conservative in the sense that it was kind of defined in the kind of post-war fusion of kind of national security conservatives, libertarians, and social conservatives. He took positions during his campaign that were anathema to all three of those groups. on infrastructure, on entitlements, even his immigration policies were outside the kind of mainstream of his party, although there was obviously a constituency for them. And so an obvious thing to ask yourself is that such a heterodox candidate, would he perhaps lead to reorganization of parties or depolarization because he took positions that were typically traditionally associated with the Democrats and anathema to his own party? So that was one possibility. But of course, what I argue happened is that, at least in many policy realms, this heterodoxy couldn't manifest itself because it was so out of sync with the rest of his party, such that the only things that he really accomplished in the first 2 years of his term were kind of conventional Republican things like tax cuts and appointing conservative judges and pursuing a deregulatory agenda, all things in which I suggested any conventional Republican president would have done. I think in the book I refer to that generic president as Jeb Rubio. It was very much on those issues. It was very much tight Trump's heterodoxy. It was, it was a Jeb Rubio presidency. The exception, of course, has been the kind of the political norm busting. Donald Trump's attempts to accelerate what political scientists have called affective polarization, negative partisanship, demonizing the other party. To try to lead to, some level of breakdown in conventional, bipartisan give and take in order to win elections. And there he has exacerbated polarization and created a situation where it's going to be very, very hard for Republicans and Democrats to work together to solve policy problems. And so I think there will be a lasting impact. I wrote the book, I was, I didn't take the direst view of the implications of his norm breaking and, attempts to accelerate, negative partisanship. I wrote something at the end, like, the fabric of our constitutional system was worn, but not torn. I spell checked the last section, got it ready to send to the publisher, and then Jeff Sessions was fired. So I resisted the temptation to reopen, the browser and and rewrite that last sentence. But I still think that's an open question about whether or not it's worn and not torn, or whether it's been actually torn.
Yeah, the book, again, is Polarization, What Everyone Needs to Know. The book is published by Oxford University Press. Nolan McCarty is the author, who you've been hearing from. Nolan, thank you very much for your time.
Great. Thanks for having me.